Good morning, folks. You are listening once again to, I say good morning, good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, whichever those three parts of the day you're at. This is Life on Planet Porky. I'm the Porkmeister, and LAJ, I tell you, it's going to be a bad day for me. It's the hottest day of the year coming up, right? Luckily, we're in the early part of the day. I insist on that because my brain fries and I can't work when we get towards midday. How are you going to survive this boiling day?
Well, what are we looking at? 33 degrees, yes. Did I hear?
Yes.
Wow. Well, it's going to be frequent cold showers and changes of clothes, isn't
that's
it?
Right.
All day long.
I agree. I agree. I can't bear it. I break out in sort of boils, if you see what I mean, which sounds horrible, but it's not that horrible. But the sunlight affects my skin. That's how badly tainted I am by sun rays. So, for instance, I have to wear a hat. If I go out, because my hair's thinning, if I go out without a hat on, my head bubbles, you know, literally like that. But anyway, look, there is one advantage of this day, and that is that when it's hot like this, I can open all the doors out into the garden, all that, and I wander around without a shirt on. However, because I'm a gentleman and I'm sitting in front of a screen now in self-isolation in my own studio at home, I've put my shirt back on just in case the camera suddenly bursts into life and you are subjected to a view of the Porkmeister torso in its uncovered state, something too horrible to bear.
Well, I'm not going to go into what I'm not wearing.
Right. Oh, dear. Right. Well, we're going to move on then. Anyway, listen, it's been a very exciting week for me for two reasons. Firstly, I have been mounting a campaign to try and get the pubs open. I know you have very extensive views on that, which I respect enormously, but I want the pubs open to get the country going again. And finally, a date has now been issued for a week on Saturday, July the 4th. But even better news, and that is that some pubs are already operating, and I've actually witnessed it. After we did our last broadcast, Leslie Ann, I decided I had a mission. I had to get on a mission. First of all, I wanted to get back into work mode travelling. So I decided to get a train into London from where I am in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey. And secondly, I'd heard rumours of a public house, quite legitimately and legally, offering a takeaway service from one of its bars in a part of London not very far from where I usually work. The train journey was terrifying. I put on cellophane gloves. I put on the mask. I carried a bottle of gel with me at all times. I didn't touch anything on the train. I had a carriage to myself, got into London Bridge and walked to the said pub. The pub was easier. As I approached it, the door was open. So somebody told me about this. I didn't know if it could possibly work. So I walked in. There was a lady behind the bar. She greeted me very warmly. I ordered a pint of lager and lime because there's no beer in barrels, if you see what I mean, because it's been taken off so long ago, it's not fresh. And I then went outside where I was advised I could use a public area, a little park, where the seats had been fixed to the floor 2 metres apart, okay? And I sat under a blossom tree and I drank this pint of lager and lime and then I had another one. And it is the most enjoyable experience I've ever had going to a pub. It was so lovely to sit in an English pub garden with only one other person there who presumably, you know, like me, had stumbled upon this place. But the sense of joy at being at a pub that had reopened again overwhelmed me.
I'm delighted that you enjoyed it so much. And I can picture you sitting there having this lovely experience after so many months of being deprived. But, you know, this pub and every other pub cannot make money from two of you in the back garden having a lager and lime. So when those pubs get very busy and are heaving with customers, and did I read correctly that you have to now make an appointment?
Well,
to go to
some
the pub?
Pubs you will have to make an appointment. But I suggested that right at the start. And for years I've been saying that people who go into pubs and sit there with one drink for 2 hours should be charged table time. You see what I mean? Because they're taking up all that space and they're wasting the landlord's time. So I'm not against the appointment situation if you can do it on your app, but I hate red tape because red tape slows business down. But the other thing is you might have to leave all your details so that if an outbreak is suddenly discovered, they can trace you.
Now, don't you think that people having an affair, for example, are going to give false names and addresses because they don't want someone to trace them? So that's going to fall down at the first hurdle, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I agree.
I mean, are you going to give all your personal details, your date of birth, your, you know, your bank codes, everything else to the pub?
No, no. I'm not going to give my...
I don't think this is going to work.
I'm not going to give my address either, because I've lived where I do for many years. And during some period of that time, you know, I've been on the radio live every day. And people still ask after me in some pubs in this part of the world. You know what I mean? Which is very nice, because all they want is a picture or something like that. That's not a problem. But I'm not having people coming to my door, because that's, you know, that. So if they said, you've got to give your name, I'd give them an address, but it wouldn't be where I was going to be for the next 3 days. You know what I mean?
So what if they start asking for a form of ID that has the address on it?
Well, I'm not sure they can do that, can they? I mean, look, I don't mind establishing myself to a barman, but I'm not going to have him take details and records of all those things you've just been talking about. And to be honest, the minute that people, you know, in the same position as you and I start rejecting that, that will collapse anyway. It'll just disappear. Lots of things have had to disappear, you know, that were intended. And that's going to be one of them, I think.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I just can't see that people are going to divulge that kind of information just to have a drink.
Yeah. No. Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, but I'm in a very vulnerable position, as I've bored everybody with lots of times, you know, with the age I am and the weight and my heart problems and all that kind of stuff and diabetes. So I was pretty terrified travelling on that train. I thought to myself, are you mad? You're actually travelling on a train into central London in pursuit of a pub that's open to have a couple of pints of beer. You could die for the sake of a drink. And then I thought to myself, do you know what? I wouldn't be the first person in history who died for the sake of a drink. And others have been much, much more careless than I have. It's just life. You know, I just think we've got to get going again. And I said to somebody yesterday, I was doing a radio interview, you can't accuse me of being selfish, because I'm not doing it just because I can. I'm doing it actually, in the words of John F. Kennedy, not because it's easy, but because it's hard, because somebody's got to lead the way. So I'm being a bit of a martyr.
Well, you've always led the way, Michael, you know.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Take charge of the situation. But you know my views on the subject. I still think it's too soon.
Yeah.
I think that we're easing down far too quickly. I'm with the former advisor of the government, Sir David King, who says, you know, we're still looking at 1,000 infections a day.
Yes.
And that rate is too high. And if you give people the option of coming down from 2 meters apart to 1 meter plus, they're all going to start jumping around, hugging and kissing. Look at what happened with Djokovic, Novak Djokovic, and his little tennis tournament in Croatia.
What a complete idiot. What a complete idiot to completely ignore everything that's going on in the world and start a tour, not just in one place, right? This wasn't going to happen in one place. He was actually on tour, taking all the celeb tennis players with him. And, oh, look, what an amazing thing has happened here. They've all got COVID-19. In my view, Djokovic now should be banned from the first major of the restarted tennis calendar. He's caused that much damage to the sport.
I have to agree with you. But, you know, he was the one who came out first and said he wasn't going to have a vaccination if one was developed.
Yeah.
And he's also married to a woman who reckons we can catch it from 5G our mobile phones.
That's right. I know, spreading all that sort of nonsense as well, just to further confuse everybody who's trying to make, you know, complete sense, if that's possible, of what's going on. Anyway, look, talking about leaders, thank you very much for that compliment of my being a leader. What about the leading tabloid magazine in America for many of the years that you and I worked there, and the programme they made about it this week, which you and I have both watched? Wasn't it astonishing?
I loved it. I was glued to it. I knew it was going to be good from the off, because, you know, the content, and because we know all these people.
Yeah.
We've worked in those environments.
Yes.
I think that, you know, the classic sort of line, which two things really stuck out for me.
And we're talking about the National Enquirer, aren't we?
The National Enquirer.
Yeah.
The reason newspapers like The Enquirer exist, and they said it themselves, because people want to see that celebrities suffer too.
Yes.
And the fact that we now have a tabloid subject who's president of the United States, which brought the whole thing full circle,
yes,
didn't it?
Right. Yeah, I mean, did you see the line in it that all the stories they used to run about Donald Trump, you know, this, you know, very brash property developer in New York, were mostly supplied by Donald Trump, the brash property developer in New York. He has such a huge ego. He wanted to see himself in the National Enquirer all the time.
And he's sitting in the back seat of a limo, phoning into the Enquirer, putting on different voices, yes, and giving false names,
yeah,
and pretending to be other people and giving tips about himself.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Now, in the 80s, the height of the Enquirer power and fame and wealth and all that, of course, we used to see guys passing through Costello's in New York all the time, you know, who were either on their way to Florida down to the Enquirer or coming back or whatever. And there was one guy there, he's a Scots fella, and I can't even remember his name now, but there were a lot of English people, by the way, worked at the Enquirer, a lot of Englishmen, Scotsmen, Irishmen, a lot of Australians and that kind of stuff. But this guy, his one job all year was to organise Generoso Pope's Christmas party. Generoso Pope, of course, was the guy who bought the Enquirer very, very cheaply, decided to turn it into a scandal mag, and then came up with the brilliant idea of selling it at supermarket checkout points. So the circulation overnight went from, you know, a few thousand, 20,000, 30,000 to not tens of millions, but 7 or 8 million. I mean, it was absolutely amazing. And Generoso Pope, the man who founded all this, insisted on having the best Christmas party in the industry. And this guy, whose name I can't even remember to this day, that was his one job all year, to travel around America enlisting great guests for the party.
It was incredible. And there was a very interesting fact here about the fact that all their major hacks were, yeah, British. And they said, they called it the city room. I assume they mean the newsroom by,
yeah,
that.
That's right.
But they said it had a very Fleet Street vibe. Well, of course it did, because, yeah, all the hacks were Brits.
That's right.
And, yeah, there was one woman interviewed and she said, well, you know, did I want to go from working on the Wall Street Journal to the National Enquirer? Mm. Well, he was offering to triple my salary, send me all over the world and give me unlimited expenses. Why wouldn't you go and,
yeah,
work there?
That's exactly right. I mean, the stories are legendary. Who was the actor in Alfred Hitchcock's most famous film, you know, with the shower curtain?
Oh, Tony Perkins?
Yeah, Tony Perkins. Yeah, that's right. I always mistake him for Anthony Hopkins. Tony Perkins, right? So Tony Perkins, right, is being interviewed on this chat show in America, and he's one of the first victims of AIDS, right? And the interviewer says, so, Tony, what was your response when the hospital first rang you up and told you that you had tested positive for HIV/AIDS? And Perkins said, no, the hospital didn't ring me up. He said, I found out that I had HIV/AIDS from the front cover of the National Enquirer. And the interviewer said, I'm sorry, what do you mean? He said, yeah, the Enquirer had paid the guy in the lab who'd done my test to give them the result before he took the result back to the hospital. And that's how Perkins found out he's got it. Isn't that amazing? Well,
they had everybody on the payroll.
Everybody.
And they also made the point about betrayal,
yeah,
didn't they? That the people closest to you in your life would be the ones to betray you the most.
It's true. It's absolutely true.
Which is terrifying. Yeah. So if you're Princess Diana, you cannot even trust your butler,
yeah,
as turned out to be the case, didn't
absolutely
it?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And doormen and the guys who parked the cars all over LA, all over Beverly Hills, were in the pay of the Enquirer.
Not only that, but the agents. So the agents were,
yeah,
shopping their own clients,
yes,
which,
that's right,
you know, we should not be shocked by this, should we?
Yeah.
And then the rates were really good. So they were paying $300 for a tip,
yeah,
in the 80s. They were paying $10,000 for the cover,
yeah,
in the 80s. Imagine that now.
Yes.
But actually, they weren't really any better than the mafia, were they? Because they were doing deals with people like Bill Cosby. They had tons of stories on Bill,
yeah,
Cosby.
That's right.
He used to phone the managing editor. They used to disappear that story and run a nice story, which he would give them instead.
Yeah.
And basically, this was protection money. This,
yes,
was the mob, wasn't it?
It was. You're absolutely right. The whole thing was utterly amazing. When you say they were paying family members, that's how they got the picture of Elvis in his coffin. A member of the Elvis,
yeah,
Presley family was given a camera to smuggle into the, you know, the funeral home and take that picture, which appeared on the front of the National Enquirer, you know, world-shattering picture of Elvis in his coffin. And the sequel to that is, do you remember a chap called Terry Willows who worked in LA?
Vaguely,
yeah.
Yeah,
vaguely, yeah. He was a freelancer, he had a freelance agency. There were loads of them around in those days who went over from here, you know, to make their fortune in Hollywood in LA. And Terry Willows was working for an agency over there. And something happened in which they acquired the picture of Elvis in his coffin, right? And they opened up a company and started selling T-shirts with that image on it, right? But the image, despite the fact it had been obtained through, you know, very despicable means, still belonged to the National Enquirer. So the National Enquirer complained, and Terry Willows was at his desk in working as a freelancer in LA when a team of FBI guys came in, came up to his desk, asked him who he was. He said yes. They pulled guns on him and escorted him out of the building, and Terry was so terrified he fainted.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's called an ambulance and taken to hospital. I mean, you know, it's legend and all that kind of stuff. But we mustn't talk for too long about this, Leslie Ann, because people listening to this podcast might think that we approve of that scurrilous behaviour. I have for years been saying...
Of course we don't.
I've been saying for years that I'm a very proud member of Her Majesty's gutter press, but there are certain lines that we'd have drawn on this side of the Atlantic, which they certainly didn't at the National Enquirer. Now, may I ask you a question, Leslie Ann? What do you
Anything.
Think of the concept of nepotism?
Well, it goes on all the time, and it has done since the dawn of time, hasn't it?
Yes.
I think, yes, look, some people are going to use their parental contacts, let's call them. If your dad or your mom is famous, you're going to get attention. It gets you through the door.
Yeah.
After that, it's all down to talent and hard work. And a lot of these people come unstuck because of that.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Now, the reason I'm asking is because a new series on telly has just started. I know you're not a great television watcher, but it's called The Luminaries, and it's a BBC period drama. And, you know, I like TV dramas and all that kind of stuff. I don't think this is terribly good. But one of the leading actresses in this is a lady called, let me get this right, her surname is Hewson.
Yeah, she's Bono's daughter, Eve Hewson.
Eve Hewson, absolutely right, Bono's daughter. But in an interview in the Radio Times about the series, she made it absolutely crystal clear that the only reason she ever got the interview for the part was because her dad was Bono. She was refreshingly honest about it. And I have to say that I'm not against nepotism, because nepotism sometimes works on the basis that, well, you know, I'm going to bring my son into the business, or my daughter, or something like that. Very much like Mr. Rupert Murdoch has done, who we've both worked for over the years, okay? But isn't that a good thing? Because can't you then say, look, the one person I can trust is my son, or my daughter, or my brother, or something like that, not taking a chance an outsider's coming in trying to screw you over?
Yeah, but by the same token, you know, there's no guarantee that just because you're John Lennon's son, that you're going to be a fantastic songwriter and musician.
Yes.
Having said that, I've always been a fan of Julian Lennon's, and I was really disappointed that he didn't take his music career further than he did.
Yes.
I think he had a lot going for him, but what he couldn't cope with were the constant comparisons with his father.
I totally agree.
Sean Lennon, the younger son, has been a musician for all these years. He's in his 40s now.
Yeah.
We don't hear much about him because he doesn't need the money. You know, he's just making music because he wants to.
Yeah.
But then you've got somebody you've got Coco Sumner, who's the daughter of Sting.
Yeah.
And whatever her name is, the Erin Dors. Anyway. Least said about her, the better.
Oh, okay. I can see you're not a big fan.
Yeah, there's a story behind that. But,
oh, really? Do we need to hear that story?
Probably not here and now.
Oh,
but
right, okay.
After we've been to the pub, maybe let's do another podcast and we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
So Coco Sumner, she launched herself as a musician. Not really my cup of tea. It's all a bit electronic and stuff, but it didn't happen for her. There was an initial flurry because obviously this is Sting's daughter. You know, everybody listen.
Yes.
Wasn't really a lot going for her. She's now reinvented herself as Elliot Sumner and she's having another go. You've got to have the talent. Talent is not inherited. Hmm. You don't get that through your genes. You've just got to work for it.
Yeah,
10,000 hours, guys. You know, it doesn't matter in the end who mum and dad are. You've still got to be able to do it.
Yeah. Well, I've never heard of her, so she hasn't made that much of an impression. Because, as you know, you and I, we keep pretty much up to date with ongoing trends. We read things because we have to, because it's our business. And I have to say, she's never made the slightest impression on me. And I'm not putting her down. I'm not putting anybody down. I'm just saying that, you know, it's not a recognisable name for me.
No. And I think you've actually got nowadays as well, this is quite a nice phenomenon of sons and daughters, mainly sons, of former rock artists who are being the tribute bands to their dads.
Yeah.
So Greg Allman's oldest son, he leads the Michael Allman Band.
Yes.
And several of his other kids are in bands. John Bonham's son, Jason, he's a drummer with Led Zeppelin, and he's got a Led Zeppelin tribute group, that kind of thing.
Sure.
But I do think there's a sense of entitlement in a lot of these people, you know, that they feel, look how many are models, you know, Rod Stewart's daughters, Mick Jagger's daughters. Why can't they just get an education?
That's not always
there. Why can't they get an education and get a real job?
Yeah, but the people who employ them are just starstruck with names, aren't they? Oh, you're so-and-so. I mean, who was it? A lot of Jagger's daughters went into sort of modelling and all that kind of stuff, didn't they? Was it Lizzie Jagger?
Yeah, Lizzie and... One of the others.
And
there you go. You see, we can't even think of their names.
Well, they were just flashing the pan careers, which bubbled for about 18 months because their surname was Jagger, you know? And I feel a bit sorry for them because I totally agree with you. When you've got a father with the enormity of success and talent like Rod Stewart or Mick Jagger, you are living in a shadow for the rest of your life, no doubt about it.
Then you've got Roger Taylor, the drummer in Queen, whose daughter is a doctor, and Richard Branson's daughter is a doctor, Holly. Yeah. So, you know, there are other professions out there is all I'm saying.
Yes, sure. Listen, let me ask you a really sort of broad question. Are you going to miss shopping centres? Because I think they're going to knock an awful lot of them down. One of the consequences of COVID-19 is obviously the closure of shops and all that. But they were in big, big trouble beforehand because the footfall was disappearing due to online sales. There's one in Manchester called the Trafford Centre, which was the glittering prize of retail in the northwest of England. It might never open again.
I hate shopping centres. I always loathe them. Absolutely loathe them. Horrible, horrible places. Sort of emporia of spending and waste. It's just hideous places. I don't like them at all. I don't like shopping. I've always hated shopping.
Yeah.
If I have to get something, and we all have to get something now and again, I have to know what it is, where I'm going to get it, not need to try it on, just go there, get it, and go home. Nowadays, of course, apart from jeans, you can't buy jeans without trying them on.
Yes.
You can buy everything online. But Alexandra Shulman, we talked about this, she went to Selfridges to buy a couple of things. She wasn't allowed to try on shoes. How can you buy shoes without trying them on?
Totally agree.
So the idea is you buy them, you take them home. If they don't fit, you bring them back. But who's going to bother with that?
No, I
think we're all going to spend less. I think this is a disaster for the economy.
Yeah, well, it's a disaster for that part of the economy, but some other part of the economy will swallow it up. For instance, you might spend less on clothes and all that, but we're all going to be spending more, for instance, on things like Netflix and Amazon and Sky, because we all realise now that, you know, we haven't got enough of those and we keep buying more.
Yeah, I subscribe to Netflix. Amazon, I suppose Amazon. Books, I mean, everybody needs to read more books.
That's
I would say that, wouldn't I?
That's right. Yeah, I like shopping centres for their bigness and their symbol of a wealthy, healthy economy. You know, people going into big, you know, comfortable shops that smell of nice perfume and all that kind of stuff. But like you say, it's inevitable they're going to disappear. And maybe that'll be a good thing because I'll convert them into city centre homes. OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much for being with us today. Well, as Leanne, I have to say, we're broadcasting on the hottest day of the year. You know, I've got a hell of a day ahead of me because I've got to keep cool. You keep cool at all times. That is something that I can tell our audience for sure. I'm an avid record listener during lockdown. When I've got everything done in the afternoon, I kind of settle down, read a few of the journals I haven't seen, maybe take a beer, and then put a channel called Gold on the radio because it's great music from the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. What I didn't realise, Leslie Ann, and you will because you're an expert in it, that the Bee Gees made as many number one hit records for other people as they did for themselves. Because every time I hear something like Dolly Parton's Island in the Stream or Diana Ross's Chain Reaction, I suddenly think, hang on, that sounds like... And then the DJ says, written for them by the Bee Gees. They were quite prolific, weren't they?
Extremely prolific. The thing is, they wrote all their own songs. They wrote all these songs for themselves. Originally,
right.
It just so happened that covers of their tracks by other artists became the bigger hit. So I suppose people don't know maybe that they wrote How Can You Mend a Broken Heart for Al Green?
Really?
Hold On to My Love for Jimmy Ruffin, Woman in Love for Barbra Streisand.
If I can't have you, I don't want nobody. Who sang that?
That
I don't know.
Yvonne Elliman.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And, of course, they wrote Grease for Frankie Valli.
Of course,
Many. It just so happened that, you know, because you put a song out there, a song has two lives, really. It has its recording value and it has its publishing value.
Right.
And that song is able to be covered by anybody.
Yes.
And if somebody comes along, an artist comes along and they want a song, it just so happens to have been written by the Bee Gees.
Yeah.
That notches up another hit for them, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But they were extremely prolific. They themselves had more than, I think, 30 top 40 records, and they had 9 number ones just in this country.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're up there with the Beatles and Elvis and the Supremes.
That's right. And I'm not dwelling back to, you know, the good old days, the 60s, 70s and all that kind of stuff. The reason I mentioned them was I saw, like, a tribute programme to the Bee Gees the other night, and the watching figures were enormous. You know, there they were on stage. Only one of them left now, isn't there? Barry. But people seem to just revere them as the great musicians, which I'm absolutely sure they were. Have you ever, during your life, because you spent a lot of time in LA, got onto a machine called a Segway?
Well, I know what they are. I never actually rode one. But didn't Piers Morgan break his ankle or something, falling off one once?
Three ribs. He fell off one in Santa Monica. Santa Monica, not the boulevard, Santa Monica, the seafront. And he broke three ribs. But this was going to be the machine that was going to revolutionise everything. You know what I mean? We'd all give up walking. We'd all been whizzing around town centres on these Segways. They'd have to devise Segway lanes, like we've got cycle lanes these days. And I read over the last 24 hours they're actually discontinuing making them because they just didn't take. They just didn't take off. They cost £5,000 each. But the saddest story, and I shouldn't be laughing, is that the British chap who bought the company when it was ailing thought he could turn it round and really make it very, very popular. It was a 62-year-old Yorkshireman. His name I can't quite remember, but I've read about it over the last few hours. He took his Segway out as he owned the company along the cliff edge near his Yorkshire home. And when he moved out the way for a group of ramblers who had come the other way, he drove off the edge of the cliff and killed himself. So it doesn't have a great history, does it?
That's a horrible story. That reminds me of years ago, I was with my former husband down in the south of Spain one summer. We took a villa down there for the whole summer. It was glorious. The kids were very little. And we went to Ronda, Ronda, which is a fantastic city where there's one of the main original.
Oh, you said the Ronda Valley then. Sorry.
No, that's in Wales.
But I know. Yeah.
Ronda, the city Ronda. There's an amazing old bullring there.
Right.
And there's a museum of bullfighting paraphernalia and the little costumes. You know, they call them the traje de luces, the suit of lights that those little bullfighters wear and so on. And we went and had lunch in this amazing hotel overlooking the gorge.
Yes.
The Ronda Gorge is a very deep, very frightening looking sort of big channel in the rock there.
Right.
And there's a bridge. And there was a story in the menu about the architect of the bridge across the Ronda Gorge. When the bridge was finished, he walked out into the middle of the bridge to admire his handiwork.
Yeah.
And there was a gust of wind and it took his hat flying from his head and he reached over to get his hat, and he fell into the gorge and died.
My God, that's terrible.
Thousands of feet down into the gorge. So I think it's quite common to sort of die by your own hand in that way,
well,
as it were.
It may be. I saw a documentary on that great man Brunel the other night. It's amazing he didn't die, and what he did, he kept building tunnels that were collapsing on top of him, bridges that collapsed, falling into seas with, you know, 60-foot waves crashing him into cliffs and all that. But one of the greatest Englishmen ever, talking about great men, but not necessarily an Englishman. Have you been following the real tragedy of a chap called Steve Bing?
And oh, God, yeah, wasn't that sad story?
Well, sadly, he's connected, I don't say sadly, with Liz Hurley. And I think people have heard us talking about Liz Hurley, you know, enough to last them a lifetime. But Steve Bing was the father of Liz Hurley's child, of course, and he's had a very tragic ending, hasn't he?
Yeah, well, he threw himself out of his window, didn't he, of his apartment in Los Angeles. A really sad thing. He's, 55 years old?
Yeah.
He'd had an ongoing feud with his father, Peter, because Peter, who's loaded, you know, multi-millionaire, didn't want Liz Hurley's child, Damien, who's Steve Bing's son, and this daughter he had with some other woman, he didn't want them to inherit his fortune because he said that they were not his real grandchildren.
That's right.
They were illegitimate. So this was settled in court, and it was decreed that these children, well, they're grown-ups now, but they do have a right to inherit the money.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that this fight with his father was ongoing and that all the stress of that caused him so much pain that in the end he gave up and jumped.
Well, it's a terrible story. He inherited $600 million at the age of 18, so he immediately became a playboy. You know, he didn't work at it. He didn't suddenly, you know, develop something or become a rock star or a Bill Gates or anything like that. He was just given $600 million and became a playboy, friends of the rich and the famous and all that, lent his aircraft to Bill, what's his name, the president, Bill Clinton, when America needed a private plane to go and recover some espionage spies from Korea, believe it or not, and all this kind of stuff. And then apparently, during lockdown, he was always seeking friends. He's one of those people who never knew if somebody was his friend because of his wealth or because he was a nice guy and all that kind of stuff. And because he couldn't see anybody during the 10 weeks of lockdown, according to the reports I've read, he became more and more depressed. And then he didn't just throw himself out of the window of his apartment in Hollywood. He was on Santa Monica Boulevard, you know, which is one of the most fashionable streets in the world. And he threw himself out of the 40th floor window of a newly acquired apartment because, according to friends, he'd gone really crazy in investment over the last 10 weeks with nothing to do and had lost his whole fortune.
Yeah, well, where were those friends when he needed them, you know?
Yeah.
What this spells out for Elizabeth Hurley is that she falls on her feet whichever way, doesn't she?
Well, I suppose so, but I'm sure she doesn't sort of look at it like that, if you know what I mean. You know, she's not saying, oh, you know, that's me sorted now for the rest of life, because, of course, she's got the daughter of the two of them. But it's a terribly... I think people reach a point in life, really. Who was it who said he had it? The guy who used to work with Annie, what's-her-namer? His name was Dave, and they had the two-person group. I'm sorry I'm so vague.
Annie and Dave?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, sweet dreams are made of...
Oh, Annie Lennox and Dave Stewart was Eurythmics, yeah.
That's right. And Dave Stewart once said that the biggest problem he had in life was Paradise Syndrome. And Paradise Syndrome apparently is when you wake up in the mornings and you can't think of a single thing that's wrong with your life that you need to get on with that day. You've got tons of money, like millions. You've got great success from your musical talent. You live in a beautiful, home. Everything's great with your wife and your kids. You've got Paradise Syndrome and you simply don't know what to do. Now, would we like to reach Paradise Syndrome or not, Leslie Ann?
I think it's all about the journey, isn't it? I hate that word, journey. Everybody's on the bloody journey these days. But it's all about striving for what you want. And you've got to have a plan. You've got to retain your humility. You've got to know who your friends are.
Yeah.
And that's why you see this with a lot of rock stars, actually. Their entourage consists of their closest family members in many cases.
Yes.
And they, you know, they bring their mom and dad along, and their brother is their driver, and they've got their sister doing their accounts. And this
well, George Michael was typical of that, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, it's celebrating what would have been his 57th birthday this week as well.
Oh, is that right? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, another tragedy.
Four years ago. I know, terrible.
Mind you, he left his family in good shape. I think...
not really. He'd lost his sister after that. I mean, she never recovered from his death.
That was really shocking. I'd forgotten about that. Right, she inherited 50 million. I was going to say, he divided his 100 million pound fortune between two siblings. They got 50 million each. But you're absolutely right. Sadly, one of his sisters died as well, didn't she?
Yeah, you can have too much money and you can have no idea of who you really are.
Yeah.
And I think that was George's problem, really.
He just
didn't know who he was, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And yet people who struggle for it all the time think that, you know, oh, just give me all the money in the world and then I'll take the problems that come with it, you know? But it's a psychological...
It's not the answer. No, it's not the answer.
No.
We've seen this so many times with massive winners of lottery. And
yes, that's right. We talked about spend, Vivian Nicholson, didn't we? No, you're absolutely right. Have you ever had any dealings with James Blunt?
I've never actually. I listen to him on the radio sometimes giving interviews, and he's got a very squeaky voice.
Yes.
He's not a very masculine sounding man, is he?
No. He's done a piece just over the last couple of days. I think it was the Middle of the Times or something like that. Now I'm a middle-aged dad. I've got a nightclub at the end of my garden. That's taking dad dancing to a ridiculous level, isn't it? But
well, it is, yeah.
But I don't know how to say this. To me, James, he was an army officer, wasn't he? He became a pop star. And mm-hmm. and he's done a lot of good and a lot of, but I still don't understand the popularity of these people. I really don't get it, because when you compare the, I know I'm going to sound like an old bore now, but when you compare the quality of songs and music that you and I were brought up on, okay, you know, with some of the greatest musical talent since the Second World War, you know, with Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Queen and David Bowie and all that, I don't know how people today can appreciate James Blunt or Ed Sheeran, because their songs sound like nursery rhymes.
Okay, it's generational, isn't it? They are speaking to their generation. The same as our musicians, the ones we favoured, were speaking to us.
Yes.
And it just so happens that we think the artists we grew up on were better than the artists today, because those were the ones we became teenagers and young adults to.
Yeah.
But Ed Sheeran speaks to his generation in the same way. So we just don't get it the way our parents didn't get Bowie.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But I can tell you this, they won't be playing Ed Sheeran songs on Ed Sheeran's 80th birthday or James Blunt's. They just won't. Whereas the ones we've just talked about will endure in the same way as Beethoven and Mozart and Chopin have endured, because of the sheer quality. I think the reason that the great songwriters could write so many songs of quality was because they understood the science of music, didn't they? How, I don't know anything about music, but apparently it's about how you intersperse between chords and notes, and it's actually a science which very few people understand.
And there was very little in the way of technology back then. You know, having 24 tracks was sensational.
Yeah.
This changed the world when the Beatles started to record in that way. But of course, nowadays, they've got technology that will do everything, reproduce everything.
Yeah.
You practically don't need to be able to sing or play an instrument because it can all be done for you in the studio. But you still got to have something to say, and you've got to deliver some universal message in your song. And that, to me, is what makes a song a lasting song, something that will speak to people in decades to come.
Yeah.
And I haven't yet heard an Ed Sheeran song that I think I'm still going to be listening to this on my deathbed, you know, that it doesn't have that effect on me, but my kids love it. So I can't really speak for what they're hearing.
No, I totally agree. Sometimes if I'm up late and I'm having a late drink and all that, I'll go to Spotify or something like that and choose like half a dozen of my favourite tracks, you know. And there's a collection of 50 of them, but none of them are more recent than about sort of, you know, 1987 or something like that. But that's another story. Now, listen, I know that you've been so busy in lockdown while we've been, you know, trying to keep things going. You've kept things going remarkably well. I hope I'm not divulging a secret in telling people that you are looking now to maybe put your tumbling dice fork into audio.
Yeah, that's that came up. It's a funny thing. People have been asking me for about a year now, when is it coming out as an audiobook?
Yes.
And it is something I had intended to get round to, but just hadn't, because I'd been so busy on other projects, really. But yes, I am going to be recording Tumbling Dice as an audiobook, so you can take me to bed with you every night.
Oh, well, who could turn down an offer like that, Leslie Ann? I was speaking to somebody the other night, and they asked me a question. They said, why did Leslie Ann call her book Tumbling Dice? I don't know.
Well, it's my favourite Rolling Stones track.
Oh, really?
From the album Exile on Main Street. It's such a great track.
Isn't the opening, I love the opening two lines. Isn't it, women think I'm tasty, but they're always trying to waste me?
Well, it's the story of your life, Mike, isn't it?
Well, it is, absolutely. I know exactly.
But the whole premise of the track, Tumbling Dice, it's just been how my life has been, you know, just sort of the throw of the dice. It's all been chance, but everybody else's life is like that too, I think.
Absolutely. Well, I can recommend having a personally signed copy in my bookshelves here in my office here in Stockbroker Belt. I can recommend it to everybody. Now, Leslie Ann, you are a woman who's focused, you know, very, very intently on the COVID-19. You have great fears about it and our future, and I admire you for all of that. What do you think of the people called the behavioural scientists that politicians have had to rely on and sometimes taken advice, sometimes ignored it, Do you think behavioural scientists are a bunch of con men, or do you think we should have taken more notice of them?
Are we really spending money on this? You know, would we not have done better to spend money on the track and trace system, yes, one that actually worked? Do we really need to be told how people are going to react to being in self-isolation? I think, no, we're not in that place, yeah, right now, are we? We need to focus on getting a cure, yeah, getting a vaccine, protecting people going forward,
yeah,
working out, fine-tuning the system so that we know exactly which people are more vulnerable.
Yes.
And, you know, we know that males over 60 with underlying health conditions, for example,
yeah,
are in the vulnerable category. But why do we need to be wasting money on theories?
Yeah, well, this is a very good point. And let me read this leader from The Times, The Thunderer, you know, one of the world's great newspapers. If it wasn't clear then, it certainly is now. Among the biggest mistakes ministers have made is in the coronavirus crisis has been to listen to behavioural scientists. The idea that early restrictions would create behavioural fatigue in the public, who would then start breaking the rules, led the government directly to a fatal delay in imposing lockdown. But it was the wrong theory. The public had been eager for lockdown. The government approval ratings shot up afterwards and turned out to be far more compliant than the nudgers had guessed. Behavioural scientists were negative in their contribution to how it's been handled, not positive. So that is in total agreement with what you've just said.
Yeah. And I think, you know, right at the beginning, you know how I feel about this.
Yeah.
We should have locked down. We should have imposed martial law. I know everybody said, oh, nobody will ever impose martial law in Great Britain.
Yeah.
That'll never happen in our lifetime. It should have.
Yeah.
It worked in France. It worked in Spain. It worked in other countries.
Yeah.
They should have locked us all down and prevented us going out. We should have had to have ID to go shopping, all of that kind of thing.
Mm.
If we'd have contained it much earlier, we wouldn't be in the position we're in now.
Mm. Well, I never wanted to go that far, but, you know, how long is a piece of string? And whatever we did, there would have been problems. Just talking about those behavioural scientists, by the way, I know you're not a big TV fan, but do you remember a series called Cracker, starring that big, fat Scottish guy?
Oh, yeah. He was the guy who was Hagrid in the Harry Potter films.
Yeah.
Robbie Coltrane.
Robbie Coltrane, well done. Do you know what? When that came out, there was a flurry then of, you know, I don't know who I was working for then, but there was a flurry of going and finding the real cracker. Because these guys were, what they did is they were profilers, okay? And the police used to believe in these profilers telling them exactly the sort of person the you know, the sort of killer they should be looking for. And the biggest example of it never working was the Yorkshire Ripper, because they got profilers in all over the place and came up with exactly the wrong guy. My name is Jack, you know, in the northeast of England, a famous hoaxer who led the police a merry dance. But
yeah,
during the course of the decade when profilers were very highly paid and being taken on by police, I spoke to one ex-cop that I sometimes have a drink with, and he said in the history of criminal investigation, no profiler has ever got it right. We've never captured a vicious killer or a demented criminal through being given a profile by a profiler who we used to pay £100,000 a year to try and come up with the sort of person we are. It's just complete hokum.
And they're still paying these people.
Yeah, they are. They still hope that one of these days that, well, we might just get it right this time. Anyway,
yeah,
there you go. That's my last rant of this particular podcast. Leslie Ann, all I can say is button down the hatches, so to speak. Heat is going to be pretty unbearable for the next couple of days, but I'm sure you will keep your cool as you always do. Where can people contact you?
Oh, on Twitter at LAJ Writer.
Yes, that's great. And I'm Mike Parry 8, or you can get both of us on planetporkypod@gmail.com. Okay, folks, keep it cool as ever. And Leslie and I will be back with you again very soon.
The reason newspapers like The Enquirer exist, and they said it themselves, because people want to see that celebrities suffer too.
Yes.
And the fact that we now have a tabloid subject who's president of the United States,
yes,
which brought the whole thing full circle,
yes,
didn't it?
Right. Yeah, I mean, did you see the line in it that all the stories they used to run about Donald Trump, you know, this, you know, very brash property developer in New York, were mostly supplied by Donald Trump, the brash property developer in New York. He has such a huge ego. He wanted to see himself in the National Enquirer all the time.
And he's sitting in the back seat of a limo, phoning into the Enquirer, putting on different voices, yes, and giving false names,
yeah,
and pretending to be other people and giving tips about himself.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. I can't bear it. I break out in sort of boils, if you see what I mean, which sounds horrible, but it's not that horrible. But the sunlight affects my skin. That's how badly tainted I am by sun rays. So, for instance, I have to wear a hat. If I go out, because my hair's thinning, if I go out without a hat on, my head bubbles, you know, literally like that. I love the opening two lines, isn't it? Women think I'm tasty, but they're always trying to waste me.
Well, it's the story of your life, Mike, isn't it?
Well, it is, absolutely.